Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Neil McGregor, Director of the British Museum. To complement our exhibition of China's Terracotta Army, we'll be discussing the legacy of the first emperor in today's globalized world. In the chair is the writer and broadcaster John Snow, and joining him on the panel are China expert Jonathan Fenby, author and filmmaker Sun Shu Yun, from St. Anthony's College, Oxford, Steve Tsang, and the social entrepreneur and blogger Isaac Mao.
It's a great honour to be in on an event like this, and I can tell you this is our most oversubscribed debate that we've had of this evolving series. I mean, it's an absolutely unbelievable exhibition, and I mean, this is, in a way, one of those moments when you want to applaud the people who put it on, Jane Portal and Jan Stewart and the gallery as a whole, before we even start our proceedings. So a big hand. But I think we should also applaud the People's Republic, because it's absolutely fantastic that their generosity has extended to enabling this to happen. And what we're about tonight is kind of extrapolating what it tells us about China. And I have a feeling that, in a way, many people are here out of curiosity, out of enthusiasm, out of excitement, and possibly even out of fear. And we're going to try to pick up the threads dropped so gorgeously by the first emperor and weave them together into an understanding of where modern China is today and where we are in relation to it. So I would like to start, as we always start in these proceedings, with the inimitable director of the British Museum, Neil McGregor.
John, thank you very much. The globalized world that we're talking about today is, in fact, a world that's been with us for 250 years. And you're sitting in what is, I think, the first result of a globalized economy, the British Museum. The first time that things could be brought from all over the world and put together and compared. And in the 1750s, when the museum is founded, the country that people want to bring things from, look at, study and compare is, above all, China. And in the King's Library, in the Enlightenment Gallery, is a document just how deeply globalized the world was in 1753 when the museum starts, and the whole of 18th century England fascinated by China, by many of the things that are in the exhibition, although, of course, they couldn't then have seen or known any of them. And I want just briefly to run through some of those things that are epitomized by the exhibition that were interesting then and are still of interest today. The great achievement, of course, of the Chinese for the 18th century was, above all, the bureaucracy and the discovery of a pit of bureaucrats, which I gather in Whitehall has already become the standard collective noun, was one of the great discoveries of recent archaeology. But the exhibition begins, of course, with an element which is still, I think, strangely topical. The bells, the bronze bells, showing that the kings of Qin had claimed for some time the mandate of heaven. The notion that the ruler of China has to have an ideological basis, a theory, a theoretical, a superior source of authority, which has to be claimed, appropriated, and can be taken from other people, as the kings of Qin had. And for the 18th century, the thing Dr. Johnson, as you know, most wanted to see in China was, of course, the wall. This is, of course, not the Ming Wall that you all know, but the Qin Wall. And it raises, again, I think, many issues that are still central today. The idea of setting a limit to the state, to the nation, of defining China as other from the rest of the world, a notion that the rest of the world has very profoundly adopted, the otherness of China, the separateness of China, and the Qin Wall joining up existing elements of boundary, but never being able to establish a very coherent and clear one, and the extent to which it is possible to make a boundary, a limit, to exclude, to define, the extent to which you can actually limit the connections between your country and the rest of the world, always posed in China, fascinating from throughout the centuries. Within that wall, as you know, upstairs, we've tried to show the great state-making achievements of the first emperor, the unification of the coinage, and the extraordinary persistence of that coinage, the laws constructed and imposed under the first emperor, focusing on communal responsibilities rather than the individual, insisting on the notions of group, and the characters, the script, which allowed a uniform administration across very diverse empire, and focus on calligraphy and a shared inheritance of script, which survives in the most remarkable way. These extraordinary continuities, without parallel in Europe, of ideas put together, imposed, that create a sense of oneness in the state, which still survive, is, of course, one of the demonstrations of the exhibition. But it also raises that other question, why was it that this astonishing achievement didn't last, that very shortly after his death, the whole thing collapses? The other thing we wanted to show very clearly, and we were able to do it with the help of this wonderful model from Xi'an, it's actually my favourite thing in the whole exhibition, of the elements of mass production, the beginning of mass production, and the sophistication of mass production, which, of course, is an element that's still of some considerable importance in China today. And we did want to demonstrate that certainly in the first emperor, this is a leg iron, the conditions of employment were sometimes less than optimal. But the focus, the result, the army itself, we can't, of course, show as you see it and experience it in Xi'an, where the overwhelming effect is one of mass, of group, of community. The experience upstairs is much more, of course, one of the individual. Individual figures individually observed, bodies looked at carefully in terms of how they have been shaped by the work that they do, by the kind of fighting they do. The difference between the archer and the bureaucrat is very striking, and everybody, of course, has been startled to be able to see close up the extraordinary difference of the faces. Clearly a demonstration of ethnic diversity, important then to show that China embraces the different nationalities, the different racial groups, just as it is today, but also raising a very important question, I think, about how different cultures look at individuals. For most European commentators, these are all sharply differentiated individuals, whereas you can see them, of course, also as minor variations on a mass-produced model, depending on which kind of language you use. But what's clear is that we're looking at people who have been made to look like individuals and made by craftsmen who are themselves individuals. One of the things we really wanted to show in the exhibition is the individual hand of the makers, particularly evident, of course, in the way the hair has been modelled. So I want to finish with that fundamental polarity, I think, that the exhibition itself poses about what is the relationship between the community and the group on one side and the individual on the other, either the mass production force, the labour force working all as one, or the individual hand, showing either types or indeed individuals, and leaving you with that image and also the question, how far is the country that made this really different, and in what way, if it is, from the rest of the world? Thank you.
Now we have a very intriguing panel coming from four very different experiences, and we'll start by throwing the thing around within the panel, and then we will turn to you to join in, because, I mean, the real key to this is a degree of interactivity, which will continue on the Guardian website. Comment is free beyond this particular debate. I'll introduce each as they come. Jonathan Fenby, direct descendant of the first emperor. I mean, almost synonymous with China, a real, I mean, not old, but China hand, and former editor of the South China Post. Your thoughts?
Thank you. I was just going to say something which really elaborates on what Neil has just been saying about the first emperor's place in Chinese history as it is generally viewed. There may be some different and dissident views around the table on this. But you could say the first emperor was a successful military commander who ended a period of warring states, who established the supremacy of his particular state, who then ruled in a despotic manner until he died, having failed, of course, to find the secrets of everlasting life. And in fact, probably the mercury he took to try to keep alive actually killed him, showing that one should never try to live forever. And that after his death, the empire fell to bits very quickly, driven by factionalism, revolts, and weak leadership by his son, and after around 16 years, it was all over. And then the much longer Han dynasty followed after a bit of infighting between then. So you could say, right, this is just another of history's military despots who lived for a little while and then passed from the scene. But in fact, I think that the importance of the first emperor, as shown in the exhibition here, is the way in which he set templates for Chinese history, which continued through the empire and which in some ways continue today. Some of those Neil has referred to, but there were the idea of strong centralization. He came after a period, as I say, of anarchy, fighting between states and two previous dynasties, which we know very little about, but which certainly didn't have the kind of power of the first emperor. He established centralization, regimentation, standardization. He built a state. He applied the doctrine of legalism as against Confucianism, legalism being the rule by law rather than the rule of law, and summed up by one of its early exponents in the terms that people are afraid of fire, therefore very few people are burnt to death, but people are seduced by water, therefore many people are drowned. So if you want to run a state in the interests of the safety and welfare of the people, your laws should be like fire and not like water, and they should be afraid of them. Hence this idea of fear of top-down rule. There was the mass production that we've talked about, the mass use of labour, which has often been a feature of Chinese history. And above all, there is the image of the first emperor as the unifier, the man who brought China together, who ruled under the mandate of heaven, who therefore could claim that China and its ruler were something special. They weren't just another state and another despotic ruler. They had a particular place in the cosmology and could claim to be a universal power in that sense. Of course, the downsides of the first emperor don't have to be hidden, and they're quite evident. I think they're brought out in parts of the exhibition and in biographies of him. And after his death, again, in a tradition which I think runs through Chinese history, he became the subject of many myths. One doesn't quite know whether to believe everything about him or just a small portion of it. Did he really bury the scholars or not? Recent revisionist history seems to imply that that was a figure invented, figure of speech, in a sense, invented later rather than reality. But it doesn't matter, because the myths become almost as important as the real person. And the unification of China, the idea of China as the centre of the world, as is clear from some of the quotations from him, with the mandate of heaven, that wonderfully flexible doctrine by which the empire could continue as dynasties rose and fell and lost the mandate through bad behaviour, which of course was usually defined by their successors claiming to be well-behaved people who deserved the mandate of heaven. All this set patterns which continued through the imperial period, sometimes applied more or less draconianly, and I would say are still present today in many of the ways that China is governed, the governance of China. And that sets up the question and the contrast, which again Neil referred to, which is the contrast between the organised, centralised, regimented state and the individual, who clearly does exist and cannot be written out of history, even by the most despotic of governments. And I think that contrast, the rise, the establishment, the unity of China, and then the very swift dynastic fall, which again is a characteristic cycle in Chinese history, are among the things that one carries forward from him. And the question is how much those still apply today.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. When I went into the exhibition this morning with my two friends either side here, Shuyun and Isaac, what was very interesting was when it came to the map, you said, that's my state, and you said, that's my state. And there was an immediate rivalry, despite the great unity of the first emperor. So, Su Shuyun, filmmaker, author, what's the legacy?
I think when you look at that picture and you think, you know, what do I and this Mandarin have in common? And, you know, we live in the country that is called China. We use the same script, as Neil showed in his slide, and speak the same language. We lived under authoritarian regimes. And until my grandma's time, we even used the same coin. And the China, I think the world sees today, is very much the legacy of the first emperor. And what does that legacy really mean? And Neil covered quite a lot. I think so does Jonathan. When I wrote about this exhibition and this particular aspect, the legacy, in The Guardian a week ago, a reader sent in his response saying the first emperor must love the European Union and he must be busy writing the directives. I'm not so sure, really, because I think the first emperor, Qin Shi Huangdi, would take one look and say, look at all the tangles, discussions, debates and arguments. Where have got you to? 50 years after the Treaty of Rome that set up the EEC, and you have got nowhere. I unified a territory more than twice the size in half the time. Let me take over. I'll do it for you. But as Jonathan said, I think the goal of Qin Shi Huangdi in unifying China is admirable. It puts an end to 350 years of warring states and spare people the horrors of war. And his methods are very effective. And when we look at, some of you have perhaps have seen the exhibition, the chariots and the arrows. I think they are just examples of how he run the country, really. The chariots were really made to the width of the roads, which he built up to link the whole empire. And then the arrows were all identical with the replaceable tips. This was, you know, mass production and replaceable parts long before Henry Ford. I think, you know, this was the secret with also a strong and disciplined army, mirrored in the terracotta army, was the secret and the foundation of his success. Today, China is marshalling this efficiency to conquer the world with its manufacturers. I read in the Independent recently that 80% of the world's zips are made in one Chinatown. I think it's the same story is with the bras, socks, footballs, of course, toys. But we have a problem, you know, with lead paint. I think the Qin Shi Huangdi would not have allowed that. Each of the terracotta army had a seal of the name of the maker. If there's anything wrong, he would be in trouble. But unlike, I think, under the first emperor, this great conquest today has nothing to do with regimentation. It has everything to do with the initiatives, hard work, and the business acumen of the Chinese people. The Chinese government, all that has done is to stop telling people what to do. And it opens the door, and we rush through. Today, there are many doors that are waiting to be opened. I think there are many voices that have to be heard, many ideas to flourish. And I think, you know, if the people can be trusted to create an economic miracle, can they be trusted with other things? I think Neil is right. When you look at the exhibition, the British Museum has done a fantastic job in displaying these treasures. I remember when I first went to Xi'an to film the Terracotta Army in the pits. At the serried ranks, file after file, reminded me of the National Day Parade when I was a student. We trained for months to goose-step to the same beat past the podium in Tiananmen Square, all shouting the same slogan to salute Deng Xiaoping. And, you know, that in this beautiful exhibition, the Terracotta Army, you know, the one I saw in Xi'an, to me was a symbol of the same regimentation. But in this exhibition, you see the soldiers and the generals stand there on their own for us to come close to them, for us to admire them. We see them in the eyes, and we seem want to communicate with them. We seem to want to ask them. We wonder what they must have thought. I think perhaps for me, one thing to take away from this exhibition, that if our government begin to engage with its own people as individuals, perhaps China will begin to progress beyond the system that the first emperor left us so many centuries ago. It would be a richer future for all of us.
Xu Yun, thank you. What was the slogan?
The slogan is, this is the Deng Xiaoping, I think, when the economic reform was introduced in the mid-80s. And we want to say, long live Deng Xiaoping, just like we say, long live the emperor.
I thought 10,000 years was in it.
But in the end, we said, Ni hao, Xiaoping. Hello, Xiaoping. So we changed all our slogans.
Fine. Thank you very much. Well, Isaac Mao, you are from the new breed of China, the Shanghai WizKids, blogger, capitalist, or at least venture capitalist, the legacy. And he's come all the way from Shanghai to be with us tonight.
Yeah. I'm very excited today, but somewhat embarrassed because the first time I saw Terracotta, very, although I'm a Chinese. But anyway, it realized one of my two dreams in my life. The first dream has been realized today, and the second dream is to visit Great Wall. And because I never visited Great Wall before. But I want to share, you know, I don't want to visit Great Wall very rush, because I want to talk about the new generations in China, you know. Just like us, we live half with the legacy and half with the new ideas and free thinking in China, just because of the openness of China. And mostly important, maybe to me, is because of the internet, you know. But, you know, I think our country also, take the legacy into today's internet very well, because we can see many censorship there, definitely. And we can meet many censorship every day. Just before I came here, you know, I may meet several times of blockage when I try to visit some overseas website in China. So when I came here, you know, I just cannot, you know, break the framework in my mind. So I don't, I dare not to visit some of the website because I just thought they were blocked here, you know. So it's a framework in my mind. I think it's an invisible great wall in our mind, in many Chinese people with such kind of legacy. Also the new kind of the framework, you know, in our mind. So actually, as a blogger, you know, as a five-year-old blogger, you know, I blogged everything in my life about technology, about the thinking model, about the educational system, about the maybe some free stuff online, and the open-minded ideas, you know, I want to share with the people, especially to those young entrepreneurs in China, as those young generations, to try to break the framework. Because to me, you know, I was educated halfway under the traditional framework, you know. So the teachers told us that you cannot say that you this is right, that is wrong, you know. So you have to work in the right way. You cannot work in the wrong way. So in such a framework, you know, I think this kind of legacy makers somewhat less creative, you know, in China. But anyway, it's changing because of the internet was introduced. When the internet was first introduced, we heard that actually it was designed as an intranet, whole China intranet, because of people always think that we should design the internet to protect all the Chinese people from being heard by the outside world, just like the Great Wall, you know, to protect the Qin dynasty, the people in Qin kingdom from other maybe outside invaders. So actually, internet was firstly introduced like an intranet in China, but actually it cannot be an intranet because China opened its economy to the whole world, and all the international companies came to China. They need to communicate with their headquarters and with their international customers. So actually, the China internet eventually becomes the internet connect to the whole world. And many young people, just with such kind of maybe it's a favor from somewhere, you know, and they become more open-minded in China. And just 5 years ago, we can only find 1,000 bloggers in China. Today, we have 40 million bloggers in this country. And people blog everything, blog what they find, and blog what they're thinking, you know, about this country. And they also envision the future of this country. Maybe after 20 years, what they think about this country. So I think the legacy is good. We should try to respect the culture of China because it's our, just to me, you know, it's dream to me, you know, to visit such a historical site in Xi'an, you know, someday. But I never try to do it because I think it's somewhat a burden to modern Chinese. We should try to learn how to adapt to the modern life, adapt to the modern world, you know, to try to respect our history, also try to respect the people from around the world, other history, other heritages. So it's my understanding of the heritage, of the legacy, you know. Yeah.
Thank you very much indeed, Isaac. Steve Tsang, you're a political scientist, and you've occupied high position at St. Anthony's. What do you see as the legacy?
Well, allow me to first of all start by raising the issue of why the first emperor was called the first emperor. He was not called the first emperor by some little historians writing up history and say that he was the first emperor. He was the first emperor because he proclaimed himself the first emperor, as distinct from previously they were merely kings. And when the first empire was being created, it was not meant to be the empire of China. It was meant to be a universal empire. If you were within the empire, you were civilized. If you were outside of the empire, you were just barbarians, beyond civilization. And of course, if you have the ambition to be civilized, you would become part of the empire. Now, I think if we want to understand the legacy of the first emperor in the way how it affected how people in China look at its history, and therefore perhaps how China or the Chinese people look at its place in the world, let's move away from China for a moment and come to Europe. Imagine a rough contemporary of the first empire, first emperor, the Roman Republic, and subsequently the Roman Empire. If the Roman Empire had been resurrected in Europe periodically, from the time when it was an empire all the way down to the 19th century, how would people in Europe today feel about them? What would be the sense of that history? I mean, this is where what we're talking about in terms of how the Chinese look at their own history. When China look at themselves in terms of what China could do, we can also apply a completely modern concept and apply in the case of China. And this is the concept of a superpower. The Qin Empire, the first empire of China, was a superpower. The second empire, the Han Empire, was a superpower. In between from that almost 2,000 years ago until the last Chinese dynasty, the Manchu or the Qing dynasty, that lasts until 1911, you had a few of these periods. After the Han, you have the Xu, you have the Tang, then you have the Manchu Qing dynasty, when China was, by any measure, a superpower. In terms of the technology that allowed China to have contact with the rest of the world, China dominated. And in the way how the Chinese look at their own history, the Chinese believe that when they actually were the dominant or predominant power in the world, China was a very beneficial, benevolent empire. China was good. Su Yun just reminded us that when the first emperor ended these horrible periods called the Warring States, he put an end to war. What I think she had not actually said, and I would say it, is that what was put in place of war between the seven states before the first emperor came along and united China? Slavery of the most organized and gigantic scale. The fact that you could be seeing all these fantastic artifacts was a representation of how this great empire was using its resources. Resources that enabled the little peripheral state of Qin to unite the whole of China, and then the emperor used it and exhausted the resources of this great empire to the point of massive rebellions of everywhere. That's a fact that I think we should also bear in mind. I think we should also think about today that China is rising. The fact that China is rising is a fact. It's one of the defining features of the 21st century. The Chinese government told us that its policy is one of rising peacefully. Since then, it has been changed to become peaceful development or promoting a harmonious world. But essentially, it's the same thing. It's a policy of promoting a peaceful rise of China. Now, I'll put it to you that, to begin with, that is very much meant for external consumption. As China wanted to reassure the world that China is rising peacefully and therefore there's nothing to be worried about. I'll also put it to you that the Chinese government is completely sincere in having a policy of rising peacefully for the very simple reason that it is in China's interest that its rise will be peaceful. If China's rise is not peaceful, then it will be problematic. It may not actually be able to rise. The real question is not whether the rise of China will be peaceful or not. The real question I put to you is what will China do when it has risen, whatever risen actually means. I think that is something that we should be discussing.
Well, when we talked about this earlier, if we pick up some of the points that have emerged, Jonathan, you said that in the last five or possibly number of years since the millennium, actually things have changed pretty profoundly.
I think there is a profound change taking place in the People's Republic on one level and not on another level. Looking at it from outside in a political, administrative, state way, nothing seems to have changed. The Communist Party is still the monopoly party, and at the party congress last month, Hu Jintao insisted that only the Communist Party, operating on its Marxism-Leninism, Mao Zedong thought basis, could assure the growth that China needed. So that's sure. The talk of inner party democracy, I think, really means just making the Communist Party a rather more efficient governing organ by rooting out some old stagers from within and subjecting people to more internal criticism. It doesn't mean democracy in the Western sense. But at the same time, I would detect one thing which I think undoubtedly is happening, the other, which is a matter for interpretation that some people I know disagree with. The first is that as we enter the second generation of economic growth and economic reform, it'll be just 30 years next year since Deng Xiaoping got the best of things after Mao's death and then reasserted himself in the early 90s. You have got, whatever you call them in China, the, quote, dynamic forces, the third represent under Jiang Zemin's three represents, the people, basically, who are driving business and the economy in China, both in the private sector and increasingly within the reformed, reorganized state sector, which has been, in Western terms, downsized, streamlined, and done all the things that any Western company might dream of doing. But that group in society, which may be roughly the equivalent of the 80 million, middle-class people in China, is operating increasingly independently of the political power and operating according to its own agenda, doing its own things. It's largely defined by consumption at the moment, certainly not by any definable political move for democracy. We're not seeing the 18th, 19th century in Europe and China. But that is a whole new force within Chinese society that has never really been seen before. That's the first change.
You're of it,
and he is of it. And the second is, I think the centre is simply becoming weaker and it can't control what is going on.
But you see, you could see parallels with other parts of the world, that in actual fact this is not a uniquely Chinese experience.
No, that, it's effect, unique, that it is happening in China
indeed,
is unique.
That's indeed, but I mean, you have a government here bashing around, putting laws into effect, or trying to, because actually the politics are imploding in the face of the internet and all these other disparate forces that are playing. And you're one of these people for whom the old empire isn't the same as it is even for Stephen.
I have some different, maybe, points, maybe to Jonathan, yep. You know, because I think we cannot rely on the, because there are two kind of theories now in China, two philosophies, actually. The first philosophy is that we should try to rely on the right and wise leadership of a party, you know, or maybe a group of people, you know. And the second theory is that we should try to literate the grassroots of the people themselves to try to make them more intelligent and try to make decisions, group decisions from all the people together, you know. So the two philosophies, actually, I think they are now meet together to generate some conflicts, actually. So I think, to me, you know, I strongly believe that the grassroots intelligence is rising and they can make smarter decisions for the future of China by themselves, you know. But we still need some well-designed system to fit for the future of China. So actually, in this, maybe just in these 2 years, I see many good things or intelligent group intelligence emerge on the internet from Chinese people. They even try to define how to make our society more intelligent, to make some decisions or try to improve some of the maybe traditional systems, you know, by themselves, you know, and they will try to use some legal tools, you know, to define their own rights, or maybe try to use some of the maybe community power, you know, to try to make some good things, or maybe try to do some NGO, gather to do some NGO things. Although in China, NGO is still somewhat limited or controlled by the government. There are more and more such community of practice emerge in China. So I think, you know, we cannot, just copy the tradition of Qin Shi Huang, you know. He himself, maybe he's a hero, and he has a very intelligent, brain, you know, to control and unite the country. But I think in the 21st century, the Chinese people, they should have their own, maybe, group thinking model, you know, that can help or maybe can collaborate with those leaders, you know, to jointly make right decisions instead of generate maybe the disasters in 1960s in China, you know. So I think I don't just rely on those wisdom from maybe several elites in China. I think we should try to let the Chinese people think together, you know, to make the to decide their future, you know.
Can I pick up on something which Stephen said, which was about otherness and how the emperor saw China as, you know, the promised land, as it were, the special people, and everybody else was barbarians. I mean, again, and I think both of you have said this in the past, that Chinese do see themselves as special.
No, I don't know what you think. When I went around the exhibition just before this talk, you know, when I look at these figures, I don't regard them or think them as something of from alien past. I thought they were a part of me 2,000 years ago. I think there is, because as Stephen said, there's this continuity of this civilization, of this empire, for the past 2,000 years, unbroken. I think that kind of a consistency, and that is part of the legacy, and that is what defines us as the Chinese. And Isaac will know, probably will not remember so strongly, but when I was growing up, even today in our textbook, we say, you know, what is unique about China? It's an ancient civilization with this long history, with this glorious past, with this vast land and the inexhaustible resources. Of course, that is not true. And Jonathan will tell you that. But still, I think there is something that is clearly, you know, Chinese, defined by the land, by the language, by the culture, by a belief. That belief is a Confucian thought. And John asked me this morning how he should address me. And, of course, Isaac Mao, obviously Isaac adopted a Western style of this name. And I said, I'm Sun Shu Yun. Sun is my surname, my ancestral name. Shu Yun is my given name. For us Chinese, it's so important to put your ancestor before you, to worship them, to respect them. It's not that like they gave you DNA or they give you some inheritance. It's just a part of who you are and what you are. And, of course, that is changing. But I think within this culture, this is clearly something that we regard as our, you know, our own and unique.
But how far is it in any way at risk from these other forces that both Jonathan and Isaac have talked about?
I think it is very, it is, China is changing very fast. And Jonathan talking about the rising middle class, which is a kind of force for change and for good in many societies. And Isaac is talking about this, you know, gigantic blogger population. And 60%, he told me this morning, 60% of the Chinese internet users are between the age of 15 and 25. And obviously, this is the future for China. But what I think, as Jonathan said, there's something that hasn't changed. This system which the first emperor left us, very authoritarian system that has been with us. And there are these forces and different sections of the society which are pressing change, which are agents for change. But I think the two of them left out one thing, and perhaps one very important section in the Chinese society, and that is the vulnerable, the poor, and the dispossessed. And there's a huge, huge percent of of the population. And when we're talking about changes, of course, I think in the past 30 years, in the economic reform, so many Chinese have benefited from the reform, and so many people, and that's why they are so grateful for them. But with this rapid change coming, this growing gap, this poverty, I just give you one example. In the early 90s, for 50, almost 40 years, we had health, basically National Health Service. And in the 90s, without any discussion, without any public debate, the government just changed from national health to a very much insurance-led private health policy, and leaving tens of millions, mostly in the countryside, and we have two-thirds of the population, 800 million in the countryside, and many of them without any health care. Amartya Sen said to me, he said, Xu, in any state in this globalized world today, you cannot have such a fundamental change which affects almost every single person in this society without any engagement with the public policy. And we, our government, just did it on that. And everybody had to live with it. And today, so many of the Chinese are so just worried to death about being sick. I think that's, again, the areas where there should be a public debate. The voices should be heard. If you have a decision, you want people to follow.
But both these speakers have spoken about that yearning for a public debate, engagement, and the rest of it. But that is not a legacy of the emperor.
Well, I think we need to make a distinction between what the civilization, the cultural heritage, and the management of history. And they're not the same thing. People in China are being taught a particular brand of Chinese history, which do not necessarily bear a lot of resemblance to what actually happened. Very bold statement. If we actually look at the really grand Chinese dynasties, now the first empire, yes, we should count that. The Han dynasty, yes. Then we have the Xu, we have the Tang, and we have the Qing, which is Manchu. Of these dynasties, the Han is the only genuinely Chinese. Well, you can count the Qin as well. But beyond that, the Xu dynasty has got Turkic royal blood in the royal family. The Tang dynasty is half Turkic. The Turkic language was spoken in court in the capital of the Tang dynasty. The Qing was Manchu, not even Chinese. So the Chinese were perfectly able and happy to work with the outside world. The Chinese empire historically had been very much of a more open empire than people in China are being bought to believe. People are being bought to believe that all these authoritarian things were from the past. It's all from Confucianism. But if we look at Confucianism as a factor, then we perhaps can also look at what actually happens to Taiwan, which share the same heritage, same civilization. And when it was not under Japanese rule and under some kind of Chinese rule, under Chiang Kai-shek, Chiang Kai-shek was far more insistent in instilling in the minds of people in Taiwan Confucianism than his contemporary in control of China, Mao Zedong, who was in fact implementing an ideology that was invented in Europe and imported into China through Russia. The real Chinese were perfectly happy and able to develop democracy as they have done in Taiwan. I don't think there's something fundamentally in the civilization or in Confucianism that's actually anti-democratic. I think what Isaac has said is something very important here. In terms of how a country can be managed, if you have the kind of authoritarian system you have in China, you need to have the leadership get things right all the time for things to be in good shape. In a democracy, you can have practically idiots running it, and it can't get too far wrong. And I would prefer to have idiots running my life than have genius.
No, just to pick up a contemporary point, and in a sense from what others have said, Chu, what is interesting, I think, in China at the moment, is that, and this is not a legacy of First Emperor, as we've seen that legacy, is the rise in grassroots protests in China, which by official count, what was it, 2 years ago, totaled 58,000 protests involving more than 100 people. That's an awful lot. And you get this coming up, it's all on single issues. A lot of it is NIMBYism, or else it's against land requisition for building, it's against pollution, it's against water shortages, it's against corruption, bad behaviour by local officials, and so on. But if you do a study of some of these incidents, at any rate, what is interesting is the way the authorities now react to it. It's not send in the armed police. It's very often, let's reach a compromise with the local people. And very often, let's offer them a bit more money, which may work or may not work. Let's build some more houses, and so on and so on. And there is a kind of dialogue going on, often at, I think, a very local grassroots level. That doesn't permeate up far through the system. But in a sense, this is, and I think it's all part of both growing wealth and the flow of information, the internet, the mobile telephones, the handset ownership in Chinese cities is more than one per person, which means an awful lot of people must have four or five, communicating SMSs and so on. And all this at the grassroots is actually producing a kind of democratization is not the right word, but dialogue and protest there, which isn't fused into a movement. It's one issue things, but it seems to me quite a change.
Maybe to me, you know, I'm too far away from today's maybe the same generation, or even too advanced to my next generation, because I'm living in a different life. And I try to utilize internet as a lifelong tool to record my whole timeline of the life. So I connect to about over maybe 2,000 people on the internet over several social networking services like Facebook, like LinkedIn, or whatever, you know, you may heard. So actually, I realized that many of my ideas came from my connections, came from other people. Actually, I cannot just rely on my own intelligence to make some decisions, but I did because I well utilized other people's intelligence, because I connect to other people. So that's why I argue that we cannot depend on a small group of people, a minority of people, to make decision of China's future. Although we have a good legacy of history, heritage, although we cannot say that there could be some idiot may manage this country someday in the future, we have to find a good solution, you know, to well utilize the intelligence, the collective intelligence from all the country. But still,
Your description of developing a timeline for your life through the internet and with your 2,000 contacts and Facebook and the rest of it, yeah. I could be talking to somebody in Germany or France or Japan in the G8 of your age, and that would have nothing whatever to do with Chinese culture. You are almost describing a cultureless world, a world which is not dependent on the emperor or anybody else, but depending on sudden modern technological development, which has linked people up haphazardly.
Oh, I think it's the same theory, you know, because, you know, I don't want to insist any people here to connect to 2,000 people maybe in one night, just make friends also. I just want to say that I will utilize such kind of social connections around the world to generate a new kind of intelligence. So actually, you know, for Chinese people, you know, they strongly rely on the command and order system before, a hierarchical top-down system before. But today they have a new tool, they have a new platform to express themselves, you know, and reveal a new kind of intelligence to lead to the future, yet to define the system, how it works, you know, maybe in the future. So that's why I try to tell people, all the people around the world. Yeah.
Well, I think we should open it up, and I would like, before going to the audience, to we're very pleased to have the Chinese ambassador here. Madam, I don't know whether you would like to make any comment on what you've heard. There is some dichotomy of view here, and there's, I think, a microphone just coming up. Has anybody got the microphone?
Thank you. It's a very interesting discussion. And thank you for inviting me to make a comment. I'm sorry, I have to talk behind, with my back towards you, but I will talk both to the panelists, and I mean to talk with the audience too. Let me start with a comment on the marching through the Tiananmen Square by Sun Shuyun. That was 1984. And I happened to be on the podium watching the marching as an interpreter. I was working for I think it was the wife of the president of Zimbabwe. And I saw the students of the University of Sun Shuyun. That was the most disordered crowd. And they put up a slogan, which I'm sure Deng Xiaoping looked and was pleased. It was a slogan written by hands, "Hello, Deng Xiaoping." And that scene appeared in China on many occasions to show the emotion of the students at that time for Deng Xiaoping. But China has gone further from 1984, and if you ask my daughter if she's going to march through Tiananmen Square, I don't think she would be willing to do so, even if paid. So what do the Chinese now think of the first emperor? I'm amazed with this exhibition. I really want to compliment the excellent work of the British Museum. And I'm also amazed with the discussions on about the first emperor ever since the exhibition. But if you ask me how do the Chinese think of the first emperor, I think they just don't think of him anymore. The Chinese learn about the first emperor mainly through a textbook. In the primary school, there is one lesson, in middle school, another lesson about his merits and the atrocities he did. And especially in the middle school textbook, I downloaded it because of the exhibition, and I found there was quite in-depth analysis of his time and the reason, the historical background of what he did. The first emperor is probably the most thoroughly studied and analyzed person in Chinese history. And there was almost in every dynasty, the emperors looked into what he did and tried to learn the lessons. And you could see that most of the lessons were very well learned. Many of the things that happened during his time did not happen again, not in massive scale. There are, of course, different opinions of him. Some think, like, for example, Mao think he was a doer, and Mao thought that Confucius was a thinker, was a talker, actually. And different people in Chinese history had very different comments of him. But I think he's probably least thought of by the modern Chinese. So if you ask the people in China now, a youngster on the street, you ask him, what is the connection of the first emperor and his life now and China now? I think you will probably see blankness in the eyes, or maybe a laughter. Mm-hmm. I think I found that China has moved far, far away, and especially in the past decades. And for example, the agricultural text, which is a very important legacy for 2,600 years, was done away with last year, which I think is an important indication of China moving from an agrarian state into an industrialized state. And I was at the 17th Party Congress a week ago, and before then, I attended the three parties' conferences here in United Kingdom. And I found that there are lots of differences, but many of the topics discussed were so similar. It's the education, public health, environment. The debates were all focusing on these problems that concern everyday life of people. So when you see China, today, I think it's very hard to generalize it. As Deng Xiaoping said, China is both strong and weak, big and small. You can find lots of examples to prove any argument about China. China in the eastern part, Shanghai, the per capita GDP is 10 times of that of Guizhou. So the eastern part of China is so much grown, it's like part of Europe, and the western part is like Africa. And to handle the problems of such a huge country for any party, any government, it's not an easy thing. So although lots of people don't like the word communism, communist party, but they have to admit that there is a success. And it's been, one of the panelists mentioned Chiang Kai-shek. I don't deny there was a very good success in Taiwan in economic prosperity, but it was Chiang Kai-shek who brought this country to the verge of bankruptcy in the 1940s. The corruption, the poverty was terrible. So I think it's again, when I studied in this country during the time more or less with Sun Shuyun, and I remember my professor kept on telling me that it's very dangerous to generalize, and I like that. I use that very often. I want to use it today. And this afternoon I had a guest from Greek, and I told him about the panelists I was going to listen to, and I told him that some of the articles I read of the panelists, and asked him, I said, if there's something wrong with your government, your country, if you don't like something, do you blame Caesars? He said, no, we blame the Ottoman Empire. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador. Well, let's open it up, and we'll take two or three questions at a time so that we really get... There's a hand right in the middle if we get a microphone across. One there, and one in the turquoise top there. If, down here, in this, just in front of you. Thank you. That's two. Lovely. Two, and there's a third one coming up here, if we can get a microphone there in a moment. So let's take you first, sir.
Well, I wanted to say that I'm somehow dissatisfied with what was said, because I can see that the talk was about the new China. I can understand that, but I don't see that it was talked about the first emperor's legacy in the globalized world, because the world is not globalized at all. If I look at the financial world, there might be 25 countries benefiting from this, or maybe the group of seven, or maybe the group of three, or whatever. If I look at manufacturing, I don't see a globalized world. If I look at cultural world, I mean, if I look at British TV, it's not British really. I mean, it's very American, I would say. It's a one-way street. If I look at the world politically, it's all about visas, isn't it? If I want to go and travel somewhere, it's not a globalized world, which is a world of exchanges. So really what I heard, so to speak, was that this was a talk about a comeback of a country after a century of shame in an imperialist way. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Well, it's a provocative question, and quite a lot of it was more about globalization than about China. But yes, please mark that, and we'll respond to that. And yeah,
yes, I've got a couple of points made.
I don't know if you want to say who you are.
Yes,
then we
okay. Yeah. My name's Elizabeth Wright, currently University of Nottingham, but with decades of China history, for better or worse. I think what I find very interesting is the fact that we assume that the legacy has continued in an unbroken way all the way through. By the way, Steve, you forgot to mention the Mongol dynasty, which I think actually is quite an important one. And I think this whole question of is it unbroken or is it not unbroken is also another important one. I think it's very broken on many occasions. But I think if we look at China now, there is an assumption that because it's the Chinese Communist Party, it's a one-party state, that it is a totally united country. And I would actually say that, and I think many people would argue, that in many ways it's a de facto federal country. The provinces are enormously powerful. And I think the central government, and I think it was Jonathan who made this point, actually is not as strong as it would like to be. And although Hu Jintao brought up a number of points at the 17th Party Congress about greater local democracy, etc., local party congresses and conferences being more accountable, how do you make that happen? And I think my second point is this question of the globalized world and China as a superpower. And I actually agree that at some stage, China will be a superpower, and it's already a very strong economic power. And it can talk as much as it likes about peaceful rise. But I think being a superpower is a very difficult thing. And I can't think of a single superpower that has not actually either behaved badly or been perceived as behaving badly. And China, with the best intentions in the world, maybe, is already having to contend with being accused of neocolonialism in Africa. And it can say, but we're paying for the resources that we are buying. Yes, but the resources are still going. Another small point, I think people always say the Chinese are all the same. I actually find them deeply individualistic, and I often think that China is in a barely controlled state of anarchy, and I greatly admire anyone who tries to rule it. Thank you.
And finally, here, just in this row here, yeah. Thank you.
Can I actually say that I think the poor first emperor has been hard done by? The way he's been described by four speakers, he seemed to have no redeeming feature whatsoever. But I would suggest that his redeeming features were two. One, he could unite such a huge country with so many different cultures, tradition, and group of people. Now, that has to be a phenomenal achievement, and we need to kind of understand, if you're going to understand his legacy, we need to understand how the hell he did it. And second is that he clearly had a notion of civilization. Now, you cannot say just because China is an authoritarian state today that the legacy of the emperor continues, because the current authoritarian regime, as was pointed out, was basically based on a model that was created in Europe, which has no notion of civilization as such. So he clearly had a notion of civilization, and therefore some idea of what a civic society was all about. And part of his legacy is that his idea of civilization and his idea of civic society collapsed very quickly afterwards. So we need to find out, why did they collapse? What happened? Right? Did the center actually did not hold? And if the center cannot hold, can modern China continue to exist as a unified state? In a sense, I mean, somebody pointed out that they're much happier if China was ruled by democratic fools rather than strong, you know, authoritarian rulers. Well, if you are ruled by democratic fools, you may end up like Pakistan, which is not a very good, very good situation to be in. Or you can end up like Soviet Union, broken up to pieces and then ruled by the mafia. So I think China does need to work out how it's going to. I mean, it's a great opportunity how it can actually bring or synthesize individualism that now seems to be the dominant theme. And what is central to Chinese culture, which nobody's mentioned? The notion of community. you know, of the whole notion of communal. What makes a community? How the community comes together? But I mean, what I'm getting is a nightmare. I mean, if there are 14 million bloggers today, in 10 years there'll be 500 million bloggers, and that's 500 million egos out there shouting, "Look at me!" That is a nightmarish image of China, which I hope China does not follow.
Thank you very much. Well, I mean, in a sense, those were three questions that really reflected China. They were completely disparate and yet completely related. A century of shame purged by imperialism.
Well, I'm never quite sure century of shame. I mean, if this means that, if by that you mean the humiliation, the unequal treaties of the imposed by the foreigners, the West and Japan, I think myself that is a fairly easy excuse and get out, because actually China's century of shame, if you take it, or a bit more than a century, if you take the period from 1850 to Mao's death, the terrible traumas that China suffered, apart from the Japanese invasion, were actually self-inflicted. There were perhaps 80, 100 million Chinese killed by other Chinese during that period. This was a shame, a period inflicted by the Chinese largely on themselves. And I think you have to look at what's happening today in the light of that, because the Communist Party's claim, as with other rulers in the past, to offer stability has a particular importance and a particular resonance when you have that past within the living memory, certainly of people, of their parents and of their grandparents, going up to the Cultural Revolution. And stability does mean something in that sense in China, which we in the West would not appreciate. And the second thing, that in a very broad brush way, you've got hundreds of millions of people in China who, although then it's very unequal, the distribution, are benefiting materially from what's happened in the last 30 years and have got a direct stake in the system. As was said, the iron rice bowl has been thrown away, and so people save huge amounts of money in case they fall ill or to look after their parents. Rural areas are not as well doing as well, obviously, as coastal areas, but still you've got a very large block of the population which really, for the first time since the decline of the Qing, has got a stake in the present system continuing.
The federal point chimed completely with your mutual enthusiasm for your individual states on the map. She's right. It's a very interestingly difficult country to govern, and it is a very federal structure, isn't it? And the central government probably would like more power.
Well, I think there is a lot to be said about the regions having a lot of power and the central government having lost quite a lot of control in terms of the economy. In terms of the society and in terms of the politics, I'm not quite sure the government has really lost quite as much power as it's being made out to be. The Communist Party is a very unitary system in China. The party discipline is very, very strong. It's a very effective organization. The People's Liberation Army belongs to the party. It is the party's armed forces. And if you have a unitary, if you are talking about China being like a federal state, where in fact, ultimately, your party secretary in each province has far greater power than your provincial governor, and in any event, should there ever be a need to call on the army doesn't listen to the governor, but listens to the party. I don't think it's a very federal system. I think the party is still very, very strong.
Who do you listen to, the governor or the party or neither?
The blogger.
The blogger from next door.
Actually, I think there are, to China, there are many different things, different situations to different provinces, to even to different cities, you know. So I think merely one policy cannot deal with so many diversities, you know, around the country. So our theory, I mean, from as a blogger, you know, from our observation, the bloggers really solved a lot of social problems to realize their understanding of harmonious society, because they try to reach many conversations and try to interpret their understanding of the society and try to use some social powers, you know, to resolve some of the problem. For example, to rescue some of the patients, you know.
Who, but you're only 4% of the population.
Yeah, it's still small, but we can see fast growing. Maybe in the just like the gentleman said, that could be half billion bloggers maybe after another 5 years. So our theory is that only variety can absorb variety. So the current problem is that there are only few good policies, but it's not enough to deal with so many problems, social problems, from the environmental problem to food safety problem to the educational problems. So the most wise strategy is to try to use the very local power. So maybe the future could be a very diversified, you know, country from the policy making to those local problem solving, you know, yeah.
Just to answer this decentralized and the power of the provinces, I think, you know, like with anything, the cost of unification, some of the fellow speakers mentioned it, also the cost of running the country, and that relates to what that gentleman said, which we haven't really discussed today, I think, which is another important legacy or lesson, if not legacy, of the first emperor. Why did his empire fall so quickly, 15 years just after, you know, he set it up? I think when you look at how the first emperor run the country, we were talking about our individual state. The first emperor unified the seven states, and he belonged to the province north of Beijing, so he's Yan. I belong to the province, the state next to Qin Shi Huang's kingdom. It's Zhao. It was one of the most important states, probably the strongest opponent to Qin Shi Huang. And when Qin Shi Huang was the crown prince, he was sent to our state, Zhao state, as a hostage. Because in those warring states, nobody trusted anybody else. There was a treaty, it was only a piece of paper. Unless you have your crown prince there, then we can do business. So when he conquered Zhao, my state, there was a battle. He was a brilliant general. And he had, according to historical record, some people may dispute the figure, but it's roughly 425,000 soldiers was caught, ambushed, and surrendered. And he killed every single one of them. He never forgave those who treated him badly when he was a crown prince. And the cost of running that empire is very high. In some of the terracotta soldiers, behind, you know, the armor, there was some script. Some were by convicts. And again, according to historical records, you can dispute it, but it's one of the, you know, most trusted sources. And the 700,000 people who built his tombs and palaces were convicts. These were the people who, from his conquered kingdoms, and he was running the country like this. And at the time, China had a population of less than 20 million. 700,000 people on his palaces, one of the most luxurious in Chinese history, and 300,000 people building the Great Wall, and then again other projects. How could you run a country with, you know, 1/20 of your population almost as prisoners? I think the lesson of his empire was, I think, absolute rule was no guarantee of stability. And that's why during the Confucius was born in the same age of Aristotle. And during the Qin Dynasty, as Jonathan said, it was very much the rule by the emperor, of course, in the name of law, but the emperor was the law, like today. And what happened? When you had this absolute ruler who laid down the absolute rule, the country would rebel because people could not stand that kind of rule anymore. That's why when the Han Dynasty, we call ourselves Hanzuren. That's what we call, because that's the dynasty we identify with. This is the dynasty immediately replaced the Qin Dynasty, and it lasted 200 years. And what was it is the founding principle and the ideology. It's Confucianism. And for the next 2,000 years, Confucianism was updated again, new Confucianism. And what today, I'm sure the ambassador would know very well, China is again, the party is talking about a harmonious society. Harmony on the heaven was the central decree of Confucianism. So I think this kind of added a human touch to this very, very authoritarian but very cruel ruling.
So does that tell us today that the Communist Party will be able to live comfortably with the internet?
You know, how internet users interpret harmonious society is very interesting because harmonious in Chinese, 和谐, you know, but people use the similar pronunciation called river crab, 和谐, to describe the interpretation from the Communist Party. So one website was blocked. They will say that your website was harmonious, you know, to describe this kind of different perceptions to this harmonious society. So actually, I think there are two sides of the legacy from the Qin Dynasty or Qin Shi Huang. You know, the first is that the ruling mindset means that control people, you know, in a top-down structure. And the second is that the creations of those crafts and the heritage. Actually, I think in China today, we inherited the control philosophy for about 2,000 years already. But we also destroyed many heritage of the culture, you know. So I think it's a bad side of the legacy, you know. We didn't well inherit, you know. So I think to the new generation of China, you know, to the internet, although the Great Firewall is there, you know, people call the censorship system Great Firewall. The Great Firewall. You know, it is a 1 billion project, 1 billion RMB project. Actually, it's also a very large deployment in China, like the Great Wall, you know, in Qin Dynasty. So they inherited the legacy very well to try to control what people want to say, you know. But I think it's totally wrong because if they well use the creation from people, you know, to create, maybe to they can generate more innovations for this country. So I just blogged maybe about 1 month ago that I think that censorship do harms to the creation of our country. So I strongly suggest the government to remove the Great Firewall system to let people to speak out, to co-build a really harmonious society together, you know. So it's time to make such a decision. Otherwise, we may lose a chance, you know, to really build a future of China, you know.
John.
Let me just say briefly two things. First of all, while I take Steve's point about the CCP and the PLA, Elizabeth Wright is quite right about the federal nature of the country, the regional nature, which has increased under economic reform, with provinces going their own way, doing what they want to do. And it isn't just at the provincial level. A small example, a provincial vice governor in a speech recently complained. He said, yes, we want to do something about the environment. We ordered the 150 most polluting factories in the province to close down this year. And this was in November. So far, 25 have closed down, and 5 cities just refused to take any notice of what we said. Those may well be cities run by the Communist Party, where there's a different line there. The second thing is that the party congress, it was interesting that Hu Jintao, the party leader and president, put at the top of his economic agenda for his next 5-year term the development of innovation. Now, perhaps you can make something out of that. And he also, rather unusually for a Communist Party chief, said that China should develop large corporations which could market Chinese brands globally.
We're right up against it, but I know there are people who want to say. Isabel Hilton, would you like to pick up that? And then one other after that. whoever catches my...
I just wanted to go back briefly to the title, which is, what does the First Emperor's legacy mean in a globalised world? In a globalised world, questions of national identity and political organisation are pretty central. And China spent the best part of a century trying, since the collapse of the Manchu dynasty, of the Qing dynasty, trying and failing to find a modern political form. And has not yet answered the central question which is at the heart of this, which is, who does the state belong to? Does it belong to its people, or does it belong to its ruler? Under the empire, that's an easy question to answer. Of course, Qin Shi Huangdi knew that it belonged to him. In a post-imperial age, that's a question that still needs to be answered. And the official narrative that China is now constructing around figures like Qin Shi Huangdi, which is one of oldest continuous civilization, uninterrupted, and all these historic myths which have been fairly comprehensively punctured by various panelists. This doctrine of Chinese exceptionalism is actually a doctrine which says, falsely in my view, because China is very old and has never changed, therefore China does not need to change in the future. It is an avoidance. It's the invocation of Qin Huangdi and figures like him to postpone the question of change, these fundamental questions. And it involves a great deal of elision of what the notion of China is, some details of which are in this exhibition. The first caption, which says, you know, this China was divided into seven kingdoms, he united them. Well, yes, in his day, the Great Wall is a defensive fortification. Well, up to a point. If that was China, and the Great Wall is a defensive fortification, why is it in the middle of the country? If China has never invaded anyone, which is also a part of the official narrative, how did it go from the size of Qin Shi Huangdi's China to the size of Ming China, and then double after 1644 to the size of contemporary China? Now, why does this matter? Because it matters to all of us, I think, that China finds a modern political story, one that works for its people and one that works for its future. And I think that for that to work, it really has to be based on an understanding of history which is honest, and an understanding of history which can stand debate and forensic examination. And it's not a top-down narrative of this kind. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Isabel. I think that's a pretty good note on which to end. I would like to take so many more people, but we're right up against the clock. In fact, we've gone 10 minutes beyond the clock. I would just like very, very warmly to thank the British Museum for putting this on. I would like to thank you for being a wonderful audience. I wish we could have engaged further, but we can, because comment is free. And if you go to the Guardian website, we'll be able to continue any thoughts you have. You can express your joy, disappointment, anger, compassion, humour, all of which have seen some play tonight from our panel and from the audience. I'll take away one memory, which I think is an intimate memory, and that is of two women, one of whom was on the podium and one of whom had spent 6 months practising walking past her, and that the two exchanged their two experiences in a language that wasn't Chinese, in a place that isn't China, but is of the world, of a globalised world, and which gives us, I think, fantastic hope for change and for engagement. And that's an uplifting thought. Thank you very much indeed to the panel and to you. Guardian Unlimited.